Okay, so you want to know about... Okay, so... Right, okay, so the on the second homework, you want to know about the fourth question. Basically, what I want you to do there is to analyze... we agreed that open reading frames... What are open reading frames? Right. So the question is basically, what is an interesting open reading frame? An interesting open reading frame, the reason it might be a gene, is because you have in one interpretation, in one of the reading frames, you have a long series that cannot be interpreted as having a stop codon. So basically, it doesn't have to avoid stop codons in all six frames. It only has to avoid stop codons in one frame. Okay? So basically, I want you to try to write a program that will avoid stop codons. Well, that will look for long regions where there are no stop codons. Okay? And long, you can define what long is. I mean, part of this is sort of an experiment you may want to play. Long may be 50, long may be 100, long may be something statistically interesting. Yeah? They shouldn't necessarily start with ATG. And the reason is because if you imagine an organism that has a split gene, only the first codon, only the first stream will start with a ATG. Okay? Only the first exon. So if you were looking for multiple exons, okay, most of the exons would not necessarily start with ATG. So I'm really just sort of saying, finding long regions on the genome where if we interpret the frame appropriately, there is no stop codon starting from here. Okay? I want you to identify parts of exons, basically. The reason you might care about long open reading frames is one, that they might be genes. The other is they might be large exons. Okay? So you could have a gene that was in multiple pieces. Obviously, when you're interpreting the exon in its proper frame, there cannot be a stop codon anywhere in there. So the long open reading frames are likely interesting, either as exons or as genes by themselves. Okay, and right now, basically, I just want you to look for things that avoid stop codons. That's really all that I'm asking about. You can have start and stop codons in introns, right. The way I think of it, again, is the exons are the coding regions. Whatever happens in here is none of our business. It's all going to get spliced out. Okay? So we just want a long string of bases that cannot be interpreted in that phrase. You want a stream of 3x bases in a row that do not have a stop codon. Okay? In those, among those x codons. Okay? And that's something that will be deemed interesting. We want to hear. Assuming it starts with ATG? Don't even bother checking that. Okay? So I don't care whether it starts with ATG or not. You know, if you want to do some supplemental experiments to see if that helps you identify genes comparing to annotation, that might be interesting. But all I'm really asking you about are open frames, places where there is no stop codon. How long are they? You know, is it statistically interesting? Any questions? Okay. Any other questions about the homework or any or the projects? Yes. Oh no! Explain that you did it before you talked to me. That's perfectly fine. Okay, if you want to do it that way, that's fine. Okay. So. But in general, when people talk about open reading frames, you want to separate the issue of whether it starts with the right codon with whether or not it is open, okay? And whether or not it avoids, basically avoids stop codons, okay? Because they can be more easily combined afterwards. Once you have an interesting stop, you know, an interesting open reading frame, you can start to say, is it an exon? Is it a full gene? You know, it might be interesting for other reasons. Any questions? Okay, very good. Okay, so
that's the administrative stuff for today. What I'd like to now do is to finish talking about, last class we started talking about this idea of doing de novo sequencing by hybridization, using arrays of probes.
And we walked through this idea that, you know, if you build a chip of all probes of length K,
you can disambiguate it by reducing it to an Eulerian cycle problem, Eulerian path problem, okay? And that what we found was that you would get, assuming you had no hybridization errors in the assay, okay, you would have a unique reconstruction with probes of size K if there was no place where a string of length K was repeated in the sequence. Everybody sort of really remember that, okay? And so based on that, we had gone through and done this kind of analysis where basically if you take K as being the length of the probes that you're using, and you build an array of all four to the K probes, okay, basically what you got was, you know, typically the expected length of a sequence that you could uniquely disambiguate using an array of all K-mers was something on the order of 4 to the K over 2, okay? Basically, because this is where it started to get very likely that a sequence of this length would start to have a particular K-mer, a sequence of length K would be repeated, okay, within such a thing, and that would then give you a cycle in the Eulerian, in the graph that you create, and that would no longer lead to unique reconstruction. Okay? So does everybody remember that we're basically at this point? Okay? If not, any questions about the array design or how we reconstructed it? Eulerian cycles, Hamiltonian cycles, things like that? Okay? So, okay, the thing that I just wanted to conclude with, basically, with this, or just mention a little bit, is these results hold for how long, large an array would you expect to need to reconstruct a sequence if you are designing it such that your probes were all strings of length K. That was sort of the implicit assumption we made. Okay, and that led to this nice Eulerian cycle reconstruction algorithm. But the question would remain, is an array of all probes of length K likely to be a good or bad array for resolving sequences, okay, for sequencing? Is it possible that there might be a better design? If you're going to have so many probes on your array, might there be a better design than using all K-mers? Okay? Now, by one sense, I'd like to show you that the answer should be yes. Okay, that's different than saying the answer is yes. But I'd like to show you that the answer should be yes. And it has to do with sort of a notion of information theory. Suppose, let's say, I give you an array of all four to the K probes of length K. And I hybridize a sequence to it. How many of these probes are going to light up? Okay? Let's try to think of where, or I'm going to answer yes. And how many are going to answer no? Let's say, as in this particular case, we are using N, our sequence is of length N, okay, and it is uniquely reconstructible. How many probes are going to light up if the sequence is uniquely reconstructible? Okay? Something like N minus K. Does everybody see why that is? Because we agreed that the moment we had a sequence of length K in common, we were, you know, our graph would have a loop in it, and we didn't know how many, we wouldn't uniquely reconstruct the sequence. Okay? Now, for a particular K like this, let's say that we have 4 to the K, what is the value, what fraction of the, okay, so let's think about it. We say that the unique reconstruction, N, is probably about 4 to the K over 2. Okay? How many of these probes are going to be lit up? What fraction of the probes is going to be lit up? Okay? Of being positively hybridized?
in this case. Okay? We're going to get about 4 to the k over 2 that are going to light up out of 4 to the k. What fraction is that? It's basically something like the square root of n of that. Right? Does everybody sort of see that? That if we're going to get unique reconstruction out of this array, it can't be the case that too many of these probes lit up. Okay? But we can only have hope really if about square root n of them light up. Okay? Now the question is, if we were conducting an experiment, ideally, what fraction of them should light up if we're going to get the maximum amount of information from the experiment? Okay? Right now we're doing it n minus square root of them, n of them. It's n is the size of the, it's big n is the size of the array. N minus square root of n are going to be a dark, okay, or no, and square root n of them are going to be light, okay, or turned on. If we wanted to have the experiment give us the maximum amount of information, how many of those spots should be on and off? Okay, let's think about it. Okay? Say about a half of them. Okay? What would be the situation under which that experiment would give us the least amount of information? Let's look at it this way. What experiment would give us the least amount of information? Okay? If they all answered no, okay? Well, I can have my tell us that the experiment is bad. Or they all answered yes, there's very little surprise guilt. You don't get very much from this. Okay? In a formal sense, okay, there's a subject called information theory, okay, which measures somehow how much information you get from some kind of a channel, okay, some kind of information source. And the answer is that you get the most information when the source basically is unpredictable, okay? So the experiment that would somehow give you the most information would be the one that has the most possible, even a better way to think of it. If we think about it, the experiment, the chip that would give us the best information would be the one that the most number of different sequences would give us unique answers that could be uniquely reconstructed from. Okay? And we notice that if we're limited to having only square root of the number of probes light up, there are fewer ways to sort of light up those probes than if we're allowed to have half of them light up. Okay? And so my claim is that the experiment that would ideally be the best would be an array where about half the probes are expected to light up. Okay? As opposed to a small fraction. Okay? And we see that with this particular design now, we are doomed to having only a small fraction of them light up. Any questions about that? Sort of believable, not believable. Okay? Okay. So part of the art in, let's say, or the research issues in designing arrays or variations of the sequencing by hybridization procedure is to try to design experiments that give you more information per experiment than you can hope to get with a classical chip. Okay? An array of all k-mers. Okay? Any questions? So over the years, mostly algorithms people have developed a lot of different ideas as to how you might be able to get more more information from a particular array. Okay. One set of experimental protocols has been designed where they do some extra experiment on the array, and it not only tells you where whether or not a fragment hybridizes, okay, maybe you can get some information about where on the sequence it hybridizes. So, for example,
suppose, let's say, that we know that that this particular fragment occurs twice, okay? If we got things like the number of times that each k-mer occurred, that would be enough to resolve a simple graph like this. If we got ideas in more complicated graphs,
okay, about where on the sequence each kamer appeared. Okay, that might help in reconstructing it.
And there are some algorithms to try to take a look at that. One of the more cute ideas that people have looked at recently is this idea of designing arrays using what we would call universal bases.
Okay, a universal base, we know that DNA sequences are made out of A, C, G, and T. There are certain artificial nucleotide bases that have the property that they won't hybridize with anything. Okay? So, one idea of a possible probe you might be able to design would be one that would exist like maybe an A, A, C, T, N, 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 C, G, T, T. Maybe where you have 8 bases of information with 4 match anything bases between them. How many probes are there of the 4 real bases followed by 4 match anythings followed by 4 match particular bases? How many such probes can you design with that form? Well, there's 4 to the 4 possibilities for this part. How many possibilities are there for this part? 4 to the 4. If we have, insist our probe had the 4, this followed by 4 flex by something like that, that would give me 4 to the 4 times 4 to the 4, or 4 to the 8 possible probes, right? Does everybody agree that if I inserted X, you know, if I took it all, this is the same as basically having an 8-bit probe, where I just sort of paint the middle of it a different color. Okay? So the number of probes of this type are still the same as the number of 8-bits. Does everybody agree with that? Now, why might such a kind of probe potentially be useful? Okay? If it's just the same as an 8-bit probe, conceptually, but it has this extra gap in between. Okay? The reason is, we might be able to take this array and expose it to sequences such that longer sequences, so that more of the square root n of the probes will light up, and yet we still extract information from it. Notice that this particular pattern of, suppose, let's say, that this particular pattern of A, A, C, T, followed by some particular bases, C, T, T, T. Suppose this basic pattern appeared more than once on the sequence. A, A, C, T, 4, 4, 4, C, T, T, T. Would we be doomed under this kind of a probe to not be able to reconstruct it uniquely? If our array consisted of probes of length 8 with 4 base things in front of it, with 4 universal bases in the middle, this pattern might well occur twice. That would be enough to have ruined our previous reconstruction algorithm. But does it necessarily ruin this reconstruction algorithm? Okay? Remember, why would a duplicate of size 8 have a repeated sequence of size 8 ruin the previous reconstruction algorithm? That's because it corresponded to a cycle in the graph, right? But now notice this, that it could very well be that a four base pattern followed by another 4 base pattern might repeat. But the stuff inside between it might be different. This might be, you know, an A, 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 and this might be a C, 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 C. In which case, the fact that this A term may only, you know, that there may be, let's say the probe that, a probe that Matt ended, or they began differently. It might very well be that another one of our gap probes will be able to distinguish between the stuff in the middle. Okay, I don't know if I said that right. Okay, did everybody see that at least we can hold out hope now? that even if a particular the probe bases, the interesting probe bases are the same, it could be that the stuff between them is sufficiently different that when we combine the results of other probes, we can say, well, look, the pattern in front of this is different than the pattern that's in front of this, and the pattern in front of that is different than the pattern in front of that. By combining information from other probes, we might be able to disambiguate it. Okay? And
so there exist sort of interesting chip designs using these universal bases that
enable you to increase the density of probes, okay, such that you would, basically allow you to increase the information content of one of these arrays. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Well, we can. The answer is you can use other AIMRs partly to disambiguate. But if you've got a, if the induced subgraph, the one graph we talked about last time, if it has a loop, okay, if it has a cycle encoder, okay, then you're in trouble because whatever you want, you can repeat this loop an arbitrary number of times, and you will get the exact same spectra of probes answering yes and probes answering no. So the answer is, once you have one AIMR repeated, you're dead with the conventional SBH, if you're having an AIMR array, okay? Whereas there is hope to go further, okay, with this gap approach. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so in fact, you can prove that with these designs, you can actually drive the information content of these arrays to the theoretical limit, which is very good. The problem is that adding these universal bases makes the probe less reliable. And so the biological error you get from using such probes becomes high enough that the whole system probably doesn't work, okay? But it's a theoretically interesting idea. Any questions? Okay? So basically, the
world of S sequencing by hybridization is one where there are a lot of these, sort of this basic idea of using an array for de novo sequencing seems like a great idea. Theoretically, it's a very interesting idea. Somehow, the error rates for hybridization have been high enough that it hasn't quite worked out well enough to replace the gel electrophoresis machines we've talked about. But it's a very interesting idea, and one that I'm reluctant to completely let go of. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So that is all I really want to say about using SBH for sequencing. What I'd like to talk about for the rest of the class, and, next class, is some of the stuff that SBH, or these hybridization arrays, are really used for. Okay, or the algorithmic problem that arises in the real application of interpreting microarrays. Okay? So, what is it that you get from a microarray experiment?
We agree that in one of the typical microarray experiments, you have 10,000, 20,000, 60,000 probes, each of which will maybe tell for a particular gene is it on or off. Okay? And what typically happens, the kind of experiments that people typically do, is you will want to try to figure out what a gene does. Well, so you might run for every gene in the array, you might run a lot of different experiments under different conditions. Maybe you want to see plot, like one application of arrays I've been reading about recently was in studying heart transplant rejection. Okay, when you get a heart, if you have a heart that's failing, someone gives you a new heart, that's a good thing. Okay, you live. But unfortunately, if it's taking an organ from another person, your body tends to reject it, and that is bad. Okay, and so in treating patients who have sort of organ transplants, you're constantly monitoring them for rejection, OK? okay? And there's sort of drugs you can give them to fight that back once you recognize it. So one experiment that I was reading about recently was the following. Suppose you have a, you know, you take monitor a bunch of heart transplant patients over a period of time. So maybe you take their blood sample the day after they get the heart transplant, and 10 days after they get the heart transplant, and 20 days or whatever. So you have a time series where on this axis is the time after their transplant that you took their blood sample. And on this axis, you have all the genes, okay, on your microarray. And you hybridize that day's blood against one of those microarrays. In any particular array, certain genes are going to be on, correct? And certain genes are going to be off. And certain patients are suddenly going to have rejection episodes. Let's say this patient over here, okay? So different, and you can imagine building one of these time series. For each of a bunch of different patients, okay? And at some point the patient died because their heart transplant was rejected, okay? But you can just look at the array right before them, okay? Before they died, let's say, and see what change in gene expression did you have, okay? What genes went on and went off to signal that there might have been some kind of rejection, okay? And so the idea of a kind of a data mining or data search problem that might happen in analyzing microarrays, when we give an experimental data like this, you might want to learn which genes were there that behaved similarly in the last array before they died. Okay? You might want to know for the patients that didn't die, what is the similarity between their gene expression and other gene expression? Okay, the patient versus the patients who did die. Okay? You might want to know which genes were regulated in tandem. So if let's say you wanted to design a smaller array for testing, you might want to know which genes were there that in almost all the patients looked the same in every measurement. Then there was probably not additional information in having this gene than it was having that gene on the array. Or it might be that these genes were co-regulated. They had similar binding sites upstream from that gene. So making sense of this kind of data, okay, one of the first things that people do, or the immediate, you know, is making sense of that data is a complicated thing. And the usual sort of first step that I think people do when they're trying to analyze these microarray data is to do some form of clustering. What is clustering? Clustering is a somewhat ill-defined problem, I think inherently ill-defined, where when you have a bunch of data points to try to identify regions in that data point, I would say clusters, or groups of data points that seem to behave similarly. Okay? So somehow clustering is the problem, that you take a look at these points, and somehow you say, oh look, there's three of them here, there's three clusters, these points are all clustered together, these points are clustered together, these points are clustered together. Okay? Hey look, all the genes in the healthy people are clustered here, and all the genes in the unhealthy people are clustered here. That's interesting. Okay? So clustering is the act of taking statistical data, okay, and trying to identify groups that behave similarly. Any questions? Okay? So for clusters such as the ones you see here, it's pretty easy to see by eye. I think all of us would have probably identified there being three clusters of points here. Okay? But in general, identifying clusters is a tricky and ill-defined problem. Okay? So get back to our microarray problem. Let's say that we had a data set where we have a bunch of genes and a bunch of different array conditions. We want to identify which genes are, let's say, commonly regulated, meaning they go on and go off at the same time. What you really want in this place to cluster the genes into groups such that that all of these patterns look very similar within the group, that all of these genes have similar expression patterns within this group. Okay? It's very difficult to eyeball something like this. Okay? You can imagine in a typical microarray experiment, your genes is 6,000 or 10,000 or something like that. Your number of microarrays is 100. Okay? You are somehow looking to cluster genes where each gene is represented by a vector of 100 points, 100 dimensions. Okay? Typical microarray cluster experiments, you might be clustering points in high numbers of dimensions. 100 is not unheard of, 10,000 is not unheard of, 20 is not unheard of. Where, again, in this case, the points of the individual genes, okay, and the characteristic of that gene is how is that gene expressed in each one of the arrays that you had made. Okay, and now trying to find data in clusters and such things is a trickier problem and ill-defined. Okay, any questions? It should be clear that it's important, and it should be clear that it is somewhat ill-defined. Okay, any questions about clustering? Okay, so we talked a little bit about clustering the class before last, when I flashed up this picture. Here is actually an example of a clustering of a particular microarray data set. Okay? The rows here, each row corresponds to a particular microarray. This represents a time series. Let's say that it was one of those patients with heart problems. Okay? As time went by, this axis reflects time. Each, you had one array at time t1, one array at time t2, one array at time t3. This axis here represents all the different genes or probes on that array. Okay? One of the first things that they are interested in with such a, so this is actually an array that data came up in understanding cell cycle division in yeast. One of the things that was interesting is which genes were there that behaved similarly. And if you look at it out here, it's pretty clear that all these genes, at least to me, once you've permuted the genes appropriately, it is clear to me that all these genes behave quite similarly. Okay? It is clear that all these genes behaved quite similarly. Okay? That somehow the genes broke themselves naturally into a small number of clusters, okay, whose expressions were similar. Okay? Cluster analysis is the question of how do you find what those clusters are. Okay? Similarly does not mean exactly. Notice that all of these, you know, these things are certainly not point for point matches with each other within the cluster. Okay? And that, you know, so clustering is this problem of trying to identify, okay, such groups. Any questions? Okay? And like I say, typically when you talk to biologists about clustering, they will probably talk about clustering with respect to, they often think about, combine the idea of clustering with the algorithm, and confuse the idea of clustering with the algorithm that is used. The algorithm that was used here somehow built up a tree of similarities. We'll talk about such agglomerative methods in a few minutes. Okay? So when you hear people talk about clustering, sometimes you hear them talk about trees or dendrograms when they talk about clustering. When they do that, what they're really talking about is this merging tree, showing how the clusters sort of got merged together from sort of small individual clusters of one element to the final complete data set. Okay? But, so sometimes you hear people talk about that, so don't be surprised if you hear that. Any questions? Okay. So how do you cluster data? Okay, well, the first thing to know is that there are a couple different components of any cluster analysis. One thing is to make sure that you use the right, is how you're measuring the distance between points. Okay? So one way you might measure the distance between points is with, as we talked about before, when we talked about string matching.
You might be talking about an honest-to-goodness distance function. Okay? Distance functions, if they're metrics, okay, will tend to satisfy the following kind of properties. We talked about it before. Basically, a positive distance, okay, all distances are going to be greater than or equal to zero. The distance between two elements is zero if they're the same. Distance is undirected, so the distance from x to y is the same as the distance from y to x. And distance satisfies the triangle inequality. So the distance from x to y directly is less than or equal to the distance for any z from x to z plus y, z to y. Okay? So one way you can get from x to y is through a point z. If the distance function is a metric, it guarantees us that there is no point z such that you could that by going through that point you will find a path from x to z that is cheaper than the actual distance. Okay? This is clearly a desirable property for a distance measure to have, the so-called triangle inequality. And so-called distance metrics satisfy these properties. Okay, any questions? So the most common distance metric that we've seen, I mean, we saw that edit distance was a metric, okay, insertion, deletion, and substitution. In clustering, we're more commonly talking about distance kind of measures, like Euclidean distance. Euclidean distance between two points is basically the, in d dimensions, is the square root of the sum of the absolute value of the differences between each pair, okay? And this gives us a distance measure, okay? Now, suppose we were thinking about using the distance measure on this microarray data. What would be the distance, if we think about it as Euclidean distance, between the feature vector of two genes? Here I've got two genes. I want to figure out how similar they are, how far apart they are by our clustering measure. We have a measurement at each time point. Okay? The distance between them by Euclidean distance would simply be the sum of these squares, the square root of the sum of the squares of the differences between each dimension. Okay? Now, one either good thing or bad thing about this kind of a weight function is that it weights all features equally. Okay? Notice that by this measure here, none of the time points were any more important than others. Okay? Is that good or bad? Okay? Well, it depends upon your application. Okay? Could someone think about, why might that not be good for the heart attack patient data? Okay, for example. It might be that the time point right before they died was the most important one, right? So we might actually have interest in so it's not clear, or maybe that of this experiment, the guy paused and he spilled some coffee on the experiment or something like that. Okay? It's not always clear that every feature should be rated equally. Okay?
Any questions? Yeah.
Right, I guess that's a good question. One interesting question then is what actually should be the number that you get here? We agree that you're representing a data, your expression level, by, that somehow, in principle, the data for each thing is represented the value of a particular probe at a particular time. We could have this represent the actual sort of intensity value we get, the redness or greenness, or we might want to threshold that down. Okay? It might be the case that we'd be more interested in plotting did it go up or down, okay, from the previous reading. That might be all that we deem as statistically significant. So it might be, in analyzing the microarray data, the question of what do you use as the actual numerical weight here is somewhat of a tricky question. You could obviously use the scanned color intensity, but is that significant as many bits as you get back?
Is it linear? Is the value of this really linear in that intensity? It's not clear. Okay, so this is an example of one of the decisions that you would have to make in analyzing cluster data. Most of the time when people are analyzing microarray data, they quantize this down to a relatively small level. Like whether it is upregulated, whether it's sort of higher than the reference, lower than the reference, or about the same. So maybe break that down to about three levels or so. Okay? Any questions? Okay?
So the problem with these distance metrics, so one way to analyze, to compare these points, is to use, like I said, the Euclidean distance. There are other distance metrics that are well known. There's nothing magical about raising something to the second power and taking the square root of it. In general, we say that the L sub k distance would be the, basically the sum of the difference, the kth power of the absolute value of differences, raising this thing to the 1 over kth power. Okay? How does this thing change as we have larger values of k? Okay? What does that just think about? So this is another distance function we could use. In the Euclidean metric, we had k equal to 2. This is some constant that we're free to tweak. You can have k equals 3 or 4, whatever you want, or 1 or anything like that. What happens when you make k very, very large? Okay, let's think. What is the sort of meaning of this as we change the value of k? Okay? Well, let's try maybe a simpler case. What happens if k is equal to 1? Okay? What does this thing reduce to for the case of k equals 1? Okay? Does what? Becomes a Manhattan metric, but what does that mean? Okay? It basically gives you, the distance is going to be the sum of the differences of different components. Right? Now, that weights distances, so according to, if k was equal to 1,
the following data points would be equally far apart. Suppose I had something that was, this one was 5, this was 1, this was 1, this was 2, 1, this was 2, 1, this was 2. This is 5, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, versus, let's say, 2, 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1. If I'm comparing these two sets of points, the Manhattan distance between this would be 4, right? In this dimension, and the other dimensions are equal. In this one, we have a sum, again, summing up the differences. We get 1, 1, that's 2, 4, 5, okay, actually, okay, 1, this is 2, 3, 4, 5, looks like this is 2, okay? Now I claim that the distance Manhattan-wide between these two points is the same as the distance between these two points. Everybody agree? What happens if we have larger values of k? How does that rate these points? Do they get further apart, or do they remain the same? Okay, how does this thing change the relative differences between them? Okay? Suppose k was very large. Okay? What is going to happen if we sum up the differences of here to the k versus the differences here to the k? What ends up dominating? Okay? Which one? The one on the right, y. Because if you have a single big difference, a big difference raised to a big power becomes an extremely big difference. Does everybody agree with that? So one of the reasons why we might want to adjust this constant k is a question of how do we
weigh big differences relative to little differences. Okay? If we have a K that is larger than 1, okay, it has the impact of amplifying big differences rather than little differences. Okay? So why might, could someone give a reason why maybe a large K, which one do you think might be better for microarray data? Just let's making a guess like this. Can anyone argue for having a larger K rather than a smaller K? Would it be desirable to would it be more desirable to count the absolute differences between them, or to amplify big differences? Okay. Anyone want to argue for a choice of one or the other? Okay. You can identify the difference between. Well, that would argue that this is, if it was a large K, these two points would be farther apart than these two points. Okay, that's basically what it was saying. And so, if let's say you're interested in trying that let's say you've measured all your data points roughly, maybe you're not so interested in the accumulation of lots of little errors, don't really care too much for you. It's only when there's a big difference in expression on some gene that is deemed interesting to you, okay? That it means that there's probably a distinction between this element and that element. We would expect in analyzing microarray data that there's a lot of little noise between individual readings, okay? Everybody sort of agrees with that, okay? That you would expect that you're measuring all these molecules, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of noise with everything. Raising it to a high power might eliminate sort of noise that comes systematically. Okay, that would not be a, you know, that would be a smaller component of what is interesting to the method. Okay? On the other hand, if you raise it to too high a power, what happens? Suppose you raise that K to infinity. Okay? What is going to be the answer that you get back? Okay? Okay, suppose we think about a measure like this,
where we raise K to an arbitrarily large power, so it becomes infinite.
I don't think amplified is really the thing to think
of. It's a question of what the distinction is
between distances. Okay, so basically what I want to know is, if I have, let's take it two dimensions. If I have a point here A, a point here B, and a point here C. Okay? Should A be closer to B? Or should A be closer to C? Which should be the point that is deemed closer to A? Okay? And I'll claim that it depends a little bit upon which distance metric you're using. Okay? If you are using if you're using a measure where you're weighting, it's probably not. Let's say something like this. Okay? If you're weighting by Manhattan distance, you're going to be paying the price to go from here to here plus there to there. Okay, if you're rating it by a thing that only punishes the maximum, okay, that has a higher value of K, it's going to start to score this is further away. Okay, because it's going to amplify the dimension where there is a larger difference. Okay? And in the limiting case, where K goes to infinity,
you're going to be summing up the differences of all these differences raised to a huge power. Okay? The only one that's really going to matter is the single largest difference. Okay? So one problem with this is if you raise K to too high a power, only one dimension is going to be used in basically making the comparison. If you have K too small, it's going to be potentially getting trapped by a lot of noise. Okay? And exactly what the right value of K is,
is sort of unclear. Okay, but that's the kind of a thing that you might experiment with, okay, to try to figure out what is the more meaningful distance to compare it with. Any questions? Okay? So what I claim is that if you get it before you, when you start doing cluster analysis, you have to make sure you get your distance function right. One thing I will say is that a lot of the clustering programs that are used for microarrays and for other biological data don't actually even use geometric distances or distance metrics. Okay, as a computer scientist, I like distance metrics because they are have well-defined properties that should make clustering algorithms do better. One distance measure that is not a metric that appears quite often in microarray studies is using the correlation coefficient between two sequences. Okay, so one way you interpret one of these high-dimensional points is as a time series where, again, it's really what we're actually doing. We can think of one of these multi-array studies being the case that each time point corresponds to a different array. And we're taking, having a time series. A common measure of the similarity of two time series or two data states is the correlation coefficient.
The correlation coefficient is a statistical measure of two sequences that returns a value of -1 if the two streams are completely negatively correlated. Okay, every time this one goes up, that one goes down. A measure of 1 if they are perfectly correlated. If every time this thing goes up, this thing goes up. Okay? And a number in between. So the correlation coefficient, again, I don't want to go through the formula. Basically, it compares each value to the mean, each value in the sequence to the mean value. Okay? And, you know, anyway, implements that. So the interesting thing is that correlation coefficients are widely used in analyzing time series data and in these clustering programs, although what they yield is not a metric. Okay? It is not a distance, it does not yield, in comparing two sequences, it does not yield a distance function. A distance measure with those well-defined properties, okay, and this complicates certain clustering problem, you know, algorithms as a result. Any questions? Okay. So knowing how to compare before you do any kind of cluster analysis, you need to first know how to compare individual elements of your data set. The next thing you need to do is to be able to compare the distance between clusters of elements. Okay, and this is another parameter in your decision. Suppose I give you this cluster here and this cluster here. How far apart are those clusters? Okay? I will claim that there's several ways you can look at this question. If you want to ask how far apart are the gray points from the black points? Okay? There are different criteria by which you can judge it. And one possibility is that you find the nearest neighbor between the two clusters. Okay? And say, look, the distance between these two clusters is determined by the closest point in one of the clusters. Okay? That seems like a reasonable criteria. Another idea, though, might be to say, let's take a look at both clusters. We'll say the distance between two clusters is determined by the farthest pair of points within the clusters. Okay? So, how might that make a difference? You know, you want to decide, are these two points data points of the same cluster? Suppose this is one cluster and this is another cluster. Okay? If you want these two clusters to be merged together and thought of as one, which is a better measure to be used, okay, for deciding whether clusters are far apart? Okay?
Yeah.
If you use the nearest neighbor measure, okay, you're likely to decide that those two are part of the same cluster. Okay? If you use the furthest point model, this is much less likely to happen, right?
So your choice about how you relate mechanistically different clusters tells you something about the kind of shapes of clusters that you think are interesting. What kind of cluster shapes
would, so according to this first measure, the nearest neighbor.
Nearest neighbor clusters are perfectly happy to be long and thin. Correct? Okay. Furthest neighbor clusters are more likely to be compact and spherical. Okay? Which is a better measure of clustering for a particular application? Okay? I would argue it depends upon what you're trying to recognize. You know, part of it is when you look at a set of your points, you know, if you're looking for patterns here, you know, what kind of interesting case? Is suppose, let's say, you have a tight cluster of points surrounded by a loop of points some distance away. Is this one cluster or two clusters? By the nearest neighbor heuristic, you're likely to decide that that is one cluster and this is another cluster. Whereas, that may or may not be the case if you look at maximizing spherical distance. Okay, it might very well be that, you may or may not decide when do you want to merge these two clusters together.
So I'll claim that there's several, the thing to be aware of is there's several different ways you can measure the distance between clusters. Okay? You talked about nearest neighbor and furthest neighbor. Another way to measure it might be with respect to centroidal distance. Okay? Suppose, let's say, we have a set of elements here and a set of elements there. Maybe our clustering algorithm can compute some kind of an average element here, okay, and an average element there, okay, and then measure the distance between the clusters as being that from the representative center of each cluster, okay, and that seems like a perfectly fine way to do it. What might be a problem with using centroids, though?
Here would be a good example. Okay, the centroid of both clusters may or may not be a problem. The centroid of both these clusters is going to be exactly the same. If you want a measure that's going to distinguish between these two, okay, that clearly would not be very helpful. Okay, that would decide that these two are basically part of the same cluster. So a lot of times that's what you want or don't want. Okay?
A more subtle problem actually is that for certain cases, this centroid data might not be something you can obtain very easily. Suppose, let's say, that we have a distance function. Let's say that each one of these points is a distance function. Suppose all that I have, let's say I want to compare two people in this room and cluster you by distance according to my kind of distance function. I might write a program that takes as input two people, a function takes as input two people, and computes a distance between them. Okay? So what's the distance between Alex and Levon? The answer is 493. Okay? And what's the distance between Alex and Esty? Well, 297. Okay? If I have such a distance function, I claim I can compute the nearest neighbor to any point by simply for every point here finding out what the distance is between me and that. But the question is, if all I have is a distance function that operates on two elements here, can I necessarily compute a centroid? Okay? You could imagine writing a distance comparison function that compares two things, like two people. But that's a different question than whether you can compute the centroid of three people. What person here is the centroid of Alex, Esty, and Levon? Okay? So I'll claim that for analyzing non-numerical data, centroids don't always exist. Okay? Does everybody sort of see the point that I'm making? Okay, or any questions about that? So on certain kinds of data, this idea of finding the centroids of clusters and comparing them makes sense, but inherently computing the centroid requires a different kind of computation than just distance computations. Okay? Something that's maybe related to centroid computations, but we can get away with just having distance. Maybe you're going to want to compute the average distance between all the points in this cluster and all the points in that cluster. That might provide a different measure here. Okay? The important thing to see here is that so far we've already got lots of different parameters, decisions you have to make about how you cluster your data, which have nothing to do with what clustering algorithm you use. We've talked about how you measure the distance between elements and the distance between clusters. A lot of different clustering algorithms will let you vary both those things. Okay? And only once you've decided what you want to do can you then start to worry about what cluster algorithm you use. Any questions? Okay? So, the sort of most basic and probably most commonly used kind of clustering algorithms that people use are what we would call agglomerative clustering measures. Okay? These are sort of methods that start from the bottom. Each one of your data points is in its own cluster. And you then one by one go through repeated iterations to try to merge clusters together. Okay? So the simplest algorithm is basically what we would call the single link cluster. We're given two clusters. We find initially we start out, every point is in its own cluster. We then will repeatedly find what are the two closest points in different clusters. Okay? Merge them together. Merge those clusters together. Okay? And repeat until everything is in its own cluster, is in one cluster, or we have the number of clusters that we desire. Okay? Any questions about that kind of method? What algorithm does that sound like to our CS people? Okay? This idea of repeatedly doing the merging, the closest, adding an edge between the closest pair of points that do not yet really have an edge between them. What algorithm does that sound like compared to one that you've seen before? Okay? Okay. I'll claim that it sounds a lot like one of the algorithms for minimum spanning tree. Okay? If you think about these, let's say, as points in the plane, and we repeatedly merge the two closest points that are in different clusters, I claim that what you're going to end up getting is a tree. Okay? And further, I claim that you're going to be getting a minimum spanning tree of those points. Okay? So one way to think about this idea of doing agglomerative clustering is as basically finding the minimum spanning tree of a bunch of points and then deleting the large edges. The largest edges probably then correspond to things that link clusters rather than going within clusters. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that or basically agree? So the basic agglomerative algorithm, okay, is basically like minimum spanning tree, okay, and it repeatedly joins the nearest clusters. One limit is that it tends to be not a very robust measure, okay. One thing we agree is that it will produce, again, the decisions are being made on the basis of the decision to merge two clusters is made on basically the single point in both clusters that is closest. So this kind of an algorithm has a tendency to, again, produce long, skinny clusters, which a lot of people don't like. Okay? And has a chance of being fooled. If this point, for some reason, really was an experimental error and shouldn't be in the cluster, maybe it shouldn't have been a real point at all,
The presence of just one point is the reason why you're going to be merging those clusters.
So other agglomerative methods, okay, will instead try to use different notions of clustering that we said. Basically, the closest mean, the closest, median. The complete link clustering, the furthest neighbor clustering here, where we merge things based on the longest edge between them, okay, is a much more robust thing, because you're somehow making the decision. It's certainly robust in the sense that to decide whether to merge clusters, you're looking at all pairs of points between the clusters. The catch is that it becomes more computationally expensive. Okay? How much time should it take to do the minimum, the single link clustering? Basically, going through n merge steps. Okay? By the analogy with minimum spanning tree algorithm, we can reduce the time to decide what the closest point is between that span clusters within essentially linear time. So something like that takes basically n squared time. So for this measure, we're going to do n rounds, where in each case to decide whether to merge a pair of points, we're going to look at all pairs of points here and all pairs of points there. It might take n squared time. If you have n over 2 points in this cluster, n over 2 points in this cluster, it will take n squared time just to compute the distance between them. Okay? Unless you use some fancy geometric, algorithm or something like that. But in a world where you don't know what the points are, these points are embedded in high dimensions. It might take, quadratic time for comparison, for round or cubic time total for single link cluster. Okay? Any questions? So basically, I think that's actually where I'll leave it for today. We see that there are several different dimensions on clustering as far as both distance dimensions and algorithms. Okay? And these are the kind of resistance you have to resolve before you do clustering. Any questions? Yes? So one question with these kind of algorithms, when you implement them, again, we've been sort of a little bit loose about what we're defining because there's lots of different variants. One question is, do you keep track of these distances or do you recompute them? So one way that you could, let's say that we have this microarray data, each vertex represents a gene. We could, as our first step, for every gene, compute the distance to every other gene and store that in a matrix. And then it'll be constant time to do those distance computations again. The other possibility, that of course dooms us to n squared space, the other possibility is to do those computations on the fly, but these computations may be somewhat expensive, especially in a world where the data might have many dimensions. Okay, so that's one of the parameters, that comes through, that you can vary. Any questions? Okay, thanks for your attention. We'll talk today about this next question.